Both Madden and Palmieri have played key roles in the scramble at the end of a presidential race. You can hear each of them fess up to a campaign event they wish they'd not been responsible for at NPR.org. Ever wonder if you're really getting what you're promised? It's easy enough to check your dozen eggs and make sure all 12 are there. But what about the quarter pounder? How can you know if it weighs exactly 4 ounces? Or how about a pint of beer? One beer drinker is upholding a new standard of truth. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, April Baer reports on the Honest Pint Project.
Honestly, Jeff Allworth wasn't trying to stir up trouble. But living in Portland, Oregon, it was hard not to notice what was going on at local breweries.
This is Beervana, after all.
Beervana, a reference to Portland's thriving microbrew industry, is also the title of Allworth's blog, the same place where, last October, he wrote about a dark secret of bar service. Most pints of beer don't measure 16 ounces. The discussion began one day among friends over beers that Allworth suspected were lightweights.
And nobody believed me. So my friends demanded that the waiter come over and exonerate the pub, and he went and got his own measuring cup from behind the bar, and it was 14 ounces.
Allworth wrote about the incident on his blog, calling out these smaller glasses, the so-called cheater pints. Bartenders know them as shakers and keep them around for mixing cocktails. Filled all the way to the brim, they do measure 16 ounces, but that almost never happens.
No one will ever pour you a beer that full. You couldn't bring it to the table without spilling.
Terry Farndorf and her husband, John Graber, are retired brewmasters. They're fans of the Honest Pint Project, and not above a little sting operation now and then.
The weight is a little more than 16 ounces weight. We were just...
I'm thinking maybe the scale's not...
Honey, you'd have to talk to your weights and measures people to see if... I mean, I know it's 16...
Terry's a real hardliner on these matters, and she thinks most beer drinkers will agree.
You know, pint, if they're using the word pint... You know, they should really be selling you a pint.
And I don't quite agree with that, because I expect to get a pint glass of beer with a half an inch of head, which means I just know I'm getting about 14 and a half ounces.
If it was a cheater beer glass and there was started with 14, you'd be getting 12.
You're right. And then I might be a little annoyed.
In the year since Jeff Allworth founded the Honest Pint Project, at least one local pub got rid of its shakers and bought all new glassware without raising prices. But Oregon and the rest of the states still lag far behind the higher standards observed in places like Germany and the UK.
It's a 20 fluid ounces is a pint. And all glasses are government stamped. You can't serve a draft drink, unless it's in a glass with a government stamp on it.
That's Andrew Hall, publican of the Rose and Crown in Oxford, England.
There are some systems that dispense beer at exactly in England called Porter Lancastrian systems, and actually dispense 20 fluid ounces of liquid.
Sounds very mechanized.
It is horrible. Horrible. You just press a button and you stand back and there's no skill in pouring a drink at all.
The regulated British system was one of the inspirations for Jeff Allworth's Honest Pint Project. Back in Portland, he says he'll continue to raise awareness on truth in pouring issues in hopes that Oregon's measurements will someday be as good as its beers. For NPR News, I'm April Baer in Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
For Kitchen Window, I'm Bonnie Wolfe. Nicole Spiridakis writes from San Francisco about food and travel on her blog, Cucina Nicolina. She has written a piece for Kitchen Window Online about what she cooks during pumpkin season.
Hi, Bonnie.
How are you?
Good.
You find pumpkins are not just for carving scary faces into. You actually use them to cook.
Right. I use pumpkins, as most people might use, say, butternut squash, which I actually like to say that pumpkins are butternut squash's cousin in a way. They're very similar nutritionally and also how you prepare them, but they taste a little bit different, and I kind of prefer them, actually.
How would you describe the flavor? I mean, what makes it different from a squash?
Well, it's a lot smoother in a way. It's also a bit sweeter, but not too sweet, and it's kind of very mellow taste.
There are a variety of pumpkin types, and the great big ones, I guess, are mostly for carving. Can you eat those also?
You can eat them. What I found, actually, is the larger the pumpkin, kind of the more watery the taste. So if you want to have that really pure, clean pumpkin taste, what I've been recommended at my farmers markets is to get the smaller ones that are called sugar pumpkins. And you will see them when you're in your grocery store or your farmers market, and they're a lot smaller and they're very bright. So I think it goes for the same I found with zucchini as well. Like if you buy the smaller zucchini, it's more flavorful. Also, it's easier to cut.
Yes. The larger ones, aren't they grown primarily to make jack-o'-lanterns out of?
Yes. I mean, it's pretty obvious. But I think before I really knew what I was doing when I was younger, I think I thought there was only one pumpkin for, only one variety.
Well, are there a lot of varieties?
There are a few, and I actually found you can see some of the decorative ones, or they seem decorative, those small squashes, the almost mini pumpkins. You can actually cook with those as well.
Really? What can you do with those?
Well, those would be great for doing a puree with. You could even roast them whole, stick them in the oven, probably roast them for about 15 minutes, and then take it out and kind of pull it apart. And it's amazing what the oven can do. It just breaks it all down and makes it very soft and delicious.
And brings out the sugars, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What's an easy, straightforward way to roast pumpkin?
Sure. You just take your pumpkin and cut it you could probably cut it into about eight, so fairly thick slices. Scoop out the seeds, put it in a baking dish, drizzle over with some olive oil and salt, and then bake in the oven for about 15, 20 minutes.
How hot was the oven, did you say?
About 375, 400.
And then you just eat it straight out of the...
You can eat it as it is. Some people like to put maple syrup on it. Mm. If you want to go a more savory route, you can serve... I sometimes just have some roasted potatoes and a salad, and it's actually a pretty complete meal.
Getting back to the pumpkin seeds, this was one of my favorite things when I was little. You'd scoop out the pumpkins while you were carving it and then roast the seeds. Did you do that?
We did. My mom did that. She would soak them in salt water and then dry them in the oven, and it was great.
And so you can eat them as a snack or use them in other foods.
Mm-hmm. One of the recipes that I included in this piece was for a sort of pesto, actually, made with pumpkin seeds rather than pine nuts.
And those are called pepita?
Pepitas.
In Spanish-speaking countries. In your piece for Kitchen Window Online, you give recipes for the soup with pesto you mentioned, a souffle, baked pumpkin with white beans, and a pumpkin bread. What other things do you use pumpkin for?
Well, I've actually made my little Halloween tradition, grown-up tradition, is I make cupcakes, and I just use a pumpkin puree in the cupcakes. It gives sweetness without being too heavy, and I really enjoy using it because it feels healthful, but it also tastes very good. So I do cupcakes, and I have made a cake. You can make a pumpkin cake, and of course pie. I love pumpkin pie, but I think it's probably because I like pumpkin pie so much that I was wanting to explore how to use pumpkins outside of that, because can't eat pie every day.
We may want to. What do you season your pumpkin pie with?
Oh, I just use the traditional. It's pretty simple, just a little cinnamon and nutmeg.
I once made a pumpkin flan for Thanksgiving that was wonderful.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it was delicious.
Actually, yeah.
Think about that.
Well, I've also seen sweet pumpkin souffles, and I did a variation on that, but I made it savory.
Pumpkin does seem to lend more flavor than some other squashes. Like zucchini bread, I can never...
Right.
I know it adds some moisture and I'm sure some nutrients, but pumpkin bread does have a pumpkin-y taste.
It does. I think pumpkins are denser. Again, if you're getting the smaller variety, I think they're less watery and therefore the taste is more concentrated. So if you puree it and put it into something, you're really going to get that taste.
Now, people would think, oh, I'll never do this. I'm going to just get a can of puree. And you say it's not that hard.
It's really not. I mean, it's kind of the same. I look at it as the same as if you're making, if you're doing another kind of squash. Basically, to make a puree, you can roast the pumpkin, like I mentioned, cutting it, and then you want to remove the peel after it's been roasted and let it cool for a minute. Or you can peel it and then cut it up and boil it on the stove. And It is not quite as simple as opening a can, but it's a lot fresher. And I personally think it tastes a lot better. And I have tasted pumpkin pie made from a fresh pumpkin puree, and it doesn't even taste like the regular pie.
Really?
I think it tastes better.
May have to try it. Nicole, thank you so much, and enjoy your Halloween cupcakes.
Thanks, Bonnie. Take care.
We end this hour with a taste of the Mediterranean. The new cookbook, Olives and Oranges, offers recipes as simple as its titles, dishes like spaghettini with burst cherry tomatoes and roasted red peppers with garlic and celery leaves. New York chef Sarah Jenkins found inspiration for her cookbook in the taste memories of her childhood. Sarah Jenkins grew up living and eating all across Italy, Spain, France, Lebanon, and Cyprus, the daughter of a noted food writer, her mother, and a foreign correspondent, her father, now with NPR's Foreign Desk. As a chef, Sarah Jenkins has fashioned her cooking style around recollections from that childhood abroad.
My parents loved to eat. They loved to go out, you know, in France, they loved to go to fine restaurants and small restaurants. And one of my earliest memories is eating in Paris, and it must have been the local bistro on our street, and we ate there, I don't know, 5 nights a week, something like that, and I was infatuated with escargot. That was what I ate. It was the Mediterranean, and even though they were working, there seems to have been lots of sitting at restaurants by the seashore and eating fresh fish and shopping in markets and buying things from local villagers. It was just an abundance of very fresh food, uncomplicated cooking, and lots of olive oil.
You speak of fresh figs, sun-kissed figs is how you describe them, right off the tree.
Uh-huh. You know, it's something I still miss. I have a hard time actually buying figs in a store because, to me, nothing tastes so amazing as a fresh fig on a tree. And I live in Astoria, Queens now, and there's a lot of old Greek families with figs on their trees that are just starting to ripen. And I hate to say it, but I keep plotting to come down in the middle of the night and start clipping figs off their trees.
Your cookbook is titled Olives and Oranges. Why don't we start in a way backwards with an orange part of the meal? It's a recipe for red onions cooked in orange juice.
It's kind of a play on a classic Italian dish of sweet and sour onions, cipolline and agrodolce. The onions are sort of browned to become sweet and then cooked out in vinegar and cooked very slowly so that the sweetness comes out of the onion. In this case, I just substituted, I think I found some beautiful red onions one day, and maybe we had oranges in the house instead of vinegar. And so I made it that way, and I loved it. It was beautiful. The colors were really vibrant and vivid.
And then you can use this in a whole bunch of different ways.
Mm-hmm. Could be an appetizer by itself. You could put it on a piece of grilled bread or toast. You could use it as an accompaniment to roasted meats.
Just a moment ago, you talked about developing a love for escargot, but in this cookbook, you actually offer something that's not so much about the snails, but about the butter that traditionally goes on them. You have a recipe for snail butter.
Yeah. I mean, going back to France as a young adult or as an adult, I was obviously always, again, tempted by the escargot. It's sort of this comfort memory. And they rarely taste that good. They're sort of rubbery and bland, usually. And I started to realize that it's really all about the butter.
So the butter is, now anybody who's ever had escargot knows it's green.
It's garlic and parsley and a lot of parsley and butter all kind of whipped together in you could do it by hand with soft butter or you can do it in a Cuisinart. Sometimes I like to put a little lemon zest in with it too because it picks things up and adds a little spark. And a little pinch of salt. That's it.
That's the butter. You feature it with roasted scallops, which is also a very simple recipe. But tell us how, just a simple version, if you had the butter, how you would, say, roast up some scallops.
Well, I would preheat my oven so that it's about 350 degrees. And I would get, I'm very fond of heavy black cast iron pans in the home. I guess one of the big differences between a restaurant kitchen and a home kitchen is your gas and your heat. And so a heavy cast iron pan tends to really hold and retain heat, and you don't have as much of it in a home kitchen. get the pan really, really hot, put some olive oil down in it, salt the scallops, sear them, slowly feeding the pan. You would put four down and let those start to cook, and then add another three and another four so that the pan doesn't cool down. And then once I have all the scallops in there and pretty close to browned, I dot the butter and throw it in the oven and kind of let the butter melt, and it finishes cooking the scallops in about, I don't know, 3 minutes, 4 minutes.
Well, I think we've reached the point where dessert is a nice thing to be thinking about, and that gets us to olives, or in a sense olives, because one of the desserts you have, which is quite lovely and it seems very Mediterranean, is lemon olive oil cake.
One of the things that I love about Italy and the Mediterranean, I suppose, they're not huge dessert eaters. They don't eat a big slab of chocolate cake after dinner, but they love sugar for breakfast. And this cake is really often served as a breakfast cake with a cup of coffee. It's really like a pound cake using olive oil as the fat instead of butter. And using, in this case, yogurt as your liquid. You might more commonly use milk, eggs, flour, the requisite baking powder, baking soda. And I, again, like to put the zest of lemons in there. You could put oranges. You could, I don't know. I think oranges or lemons would pretty much be it.
You know, having worked on this cookbook, is there a memory that speaks to the whole sort of fragrance and flavor that you're trying to offer here?
It might be the smell of the Mediterranean in the summer when there's all kinds of weeds growing, wild oreganos and wild fennel, and there's this intense sort of perfume as you drive along the coast between a little bit of salt air and a little bit of wild herbs, and it's really dry and hot, and that just makes me feel like I need to give it all up and move back there every time I think about it.
It's a big difference than New York City.
It is.
Sarah Jenkins, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sarah Jenkins with co-author Mindy Fox is out with Olives and Oranges, Recipes and Flavors, Secrets from Italy, Spain, Cyprus, and Beyond. You can follow the recipes you've just heard by going to npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
This summer, South Korea partially lifted a ban on American beef, but the fear of mad cow disease still lingers across the country and has sparked public demonstrations and riots. That hasn't kept Koreans away from good barbecue. Rebecca Martinez ate karbi, a traditional Korean beef dish, during a visit to Seoul. She sent this audio postcard.
I backpacked around South Korea this summer and dined on succulent seafood. But after 2 weeks of fried prawns and tuna sushi rolls, I was so over the fruits of the sea.
This place is called Donenu.
On my last night in Korea, I met an old classmate, Jean, and her American friends at a busy restaurant in Seoul. Jean is Korean-American and has been a vegetarian for years, but she thought it was important for me to try her favorite food from the good old days.
It's kind of like when you're in jail, you're a prisoner, and you're on death row, and you're about to be executed, and you get your last meal. That's kind of like what karbi was for me before I went veggie. And if I ever went non-veggie, it would be because of karbi.
The five of us crowded around a small table with a grill sunken into the middle under a long black flue that hung from the ceiling. The waiter took our order and scooped some coals into the grill. We passed around steel chopsticks to dig into the side dishes, called banchan. I picked through communal bowls of soy-marinated spring onions, romaine salad with hot sauce, bean sprouts, and kimchi, the piquant fermented cabbage dish.
Ooh, this kimchi is spicy.
I don't know if that was okay.
We toasted shots of soju, a potent Korean rice liquor, and the waiter brought several cuts of marinated boneless ribs. He tossed the first cut on the grill. Gabe, a teacher from New Mexico, was put in charge of flipping and cutting the meat on the grill, not with a knife, but with a large pair of scissors. Even with the blackened edges, the ribs were sweet from the marinade and very tender. Jean asked the waiter where the beef was from.
거기는 어디 나라에서 왔어요?
네덜란드요?
네. So the meat, the beef is from the Netherlands.
Thank God it's not American.
Jean's friend Kent knows all about the Korean fear of American beef. Even McDonald's hangs posters in the window declaring that they serve Australian beef, clean and safe. Regardless of where ours came from, the beef barbecue was delicious and cheap. Now I'm back in Washington, D.C., where there's not exactly a carby restaurant on every corner. But I have heard about a place that serves great carby across the Potomac in Virginia. I'm planning to check it out and to see how the Korean specialty tastes with good old-fashioned American beef. For NPR News, I'm Rebecca Martinez.